Welcome, Melissa. Thank you, Rachel. The one person who's still paying attention in here. And from the back corner, no less. That's spectacular. All right. The rest of you be like Rachel. No, Good evening. All right, so we're going to talk about the Balaam story tonight. Balaam, for those of you from the state of Palestine. I know. It's the middle of the week. So, naturally, if we're going to talk about a story that starts in Numbers 22, we should really go to Genesis chapter 1. Makes perfect sense, but let's do that. So, go back with me to Genesis. We'll get there.
I have a question.
Please.
Did we not discuss the bronze serpent?
No. If you want to do that, we'll do that next week. We'll come back to it. We never get to everything in any quarter.
Well, I heard a preacher preach a sermon on cure for snake bite is what he called it. He used this passage that he talked about the plan of salvation along with the obedience.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. No, we part of why I take flack for never finishing a book around here is because always more to get to in one board. All right, let's start with a word of prayer. Can the brother lead us in that? Going once, going twice. Thank you, Joel.
Our wonderful and awesome God, Lord, we thank you that we are here and safe and in a place to read about your word, read from your word and study it. Lord, please bless our study and help us to come out of this with more knowledge. And Lord, we just ask that you encourage us and help us to encourage others tonight. And so in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
All right. So the reason I want to make sure we spend a decent time with the Balaam story is because it actually matters more than just a talking donkey, going back to what we usually think of. That's the part we remember, right? But there's so much more to that story than that. It goes on. And part of it is we don't really read the oracles of Balaam and understand what's going on. This is actually a very significant story. When you stop and think about it, 40 years in the wilderness, we have so few stories of what happened. And yet, in a book that compresses 40 years of wonders, the book belabors this particular story at length. Why? Because it matters more than a lot of times we appreciate. The story begins, you're still in Genesis 1, but let me read to you chapter 22 and verse 1. Then the people of Israel set out and camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho. Again, little details that we often skip over. Where are they when this story goes down? They have come, if you will, to their final stop in the wilderness before they go in the promised land. This is where they're going to be, and then you'll notice 22 verse 1, opposite Jericho. They have come to the final stop in the promised land. That's why this, one of the reasons why this story matters. The geography gives us a hint. This is literally the last stop of 40 bad years in which there's been a lot of death. And they are so close to going into the promised land now. This is where they're going to go all the way through. You open the book of Deuteronomy, Moses, on the plains of Moab. Here's the last sermon before Moses goes and dies. This is the last stop after decades of disappointment and catastrophe, okay? And so here we are on the doorstep to the promised land. And one of the great themes in the story, let me ask you, to those of you who are familiar with the story, you talk to me for a minute. What kind of themes do you pick up in the Balaam story? What kind of big ideas, themes?
Don't go against God.
Yeah, don't go against God. Don't go against God. What else? Come again? Sorry, you've got to say again?
It's not about the money or something.
Okay, good. Yes. And in fact, the New Testament likes the couple times Balaam's mentioned, it's usually in the idea of using religion for money and being willing to compromise your religion for money. And that's certainly part of it. What about this? Balaam's technically called a seer. So what's funny about that? There it is. Because he's the seer who can't see.
Is he a seer who can't see or a seer who sees but chooses not to?
Well, we'll come to that. We can say a little bit about that. But the only part of the Balaam story we really remember is when the donkey sees him, he doesn't, because God's got a sense of humor. Yeah. Right? It's a way of humiliating him. Because if the donkey, and then the other thing is the donkey sees and the donkey speaks, which is what a seer is supposed to do. See and speak truth. And so the donkey is better at being Balaam than Balaam's at being Balaam, in a sense. And it's not that Balaam doesn't know Yahweh, know what Yahweh wants. The issue is, and the story hints at this in various ways, the New Testament certainly interprets it this way, that even though he knew what Yahweh wanted, he really, really wanted the payday. And so he was going to find a way to keep on. And by the way, part of how we realize that is eventually where, even though if you know the story, by the time we get to chapter 24, the spirit of Yahweh overpowers him, and instead of cursing, he utters this profound and significant blessing, actually. But then, the very next page, the great sin of Baal Peor, which is one of the places that Balak had taken Balaam to look at Israel. And what we find out later in chapter 31 is that was Balaam's idea. You know, Balaam had a role, and if God won't let me, you know, curse them and get my payday, I'll show another way to bring them down. Unlike mixing religion and sex, and that worked. And there's a plague, and people are dying, and, you know, Balak's getting what he wants in a sense, and Balaam's hoping he gets what he wants, and the truth of the matter is everybody involved in that sad story dies. Because Balaam is killed, and all the Israelites who compromised are killed right there on the plains of Moab opposite Jericho. It's tragic. But all that to say, so certainly the theme of seeing, and by the way, one of the things that Balaam will say in chapter 24, the climax of the blessings that the Spirit of Yahweh forces him to pronounce, is now I see. Yeah. And so again, if we're reading this, and there's all sorts of, sometimes it's easier to see in Hebrew, I hate to use the cheat code, but there's all sorts of other synonyms for seeing, sight, insight, understanding. I mean, the whole thing is about seeing and not seeing, and not just the physical act, but just understanding what's really going on here. These aren't just people, these aren't just nations struggling with the work of God. And these people, they look like a ragtag group of folks in, camping and, stumbling out of the wilderness after 40 years. It's far more glorious what God's up to in these people than what it looks like. So anyway, so there's that. But here's the other thing. But even above that, because again, we usually focus on that, and it's a significant key part of the story, but because of the donkey episode, if we catch the clever humor at all. But the real key words are blessing and cursing. That's what drives this whole story, right? Because the whole reason Balaam's being called in is I need a professional curse giver. Right? And God says, don't go, and Balaam says, I really want to go. I mean, not really, but kind of like when you have kids who keep on, we've all been there. And Balaam really wants to go, and so God says, fine, but you have to go and say what I say, because these people are blessed not to be cursed. So here's the thing. This is a story that works on multiple levels, and you said the real issue is blessing and cursing. Okay, this is a story that works on the cosmic creational level. This is a story that works on the deliverance of the people level. So here's how this works. When you go back to Genesis chapter 1, when God first creates, the whole purpose of the cosmos, when God creates, there are two fundamental aspects that we all know the story, but remember Genesis chapter 1. Let's make man in our image, male and female. They make them. And God's first, I should go to Genesis 2, hypocrisy. And so when you get to Genesis chapter 1, as God determines to make mankind in his image. So he created man in his own image, and the image of God he created, the male and female, he created them. And what's the very next thing that's said in verse 28? Key word from tonight, Numbers. God wants to bless his creation. And originally, mankind, all of mankind, there's no sin. All mankind is his people, right? And so what's the fundamental verb of God's actions, disposition towards mankind and creation? God wants to, starts with a B, ends with an S, he wants to what? He wants to bless. And part of blessing is God blesses them is look at the particular nature of the blessing he pronounces. God said to them, a colloquial way to say that is, have lots of babies. I am the capital L life because I am. I am existence. I am life. And beings who bear my image, guess what I want you to do? Act like me and create life. Lots of it. Because flourishing, life, shalom. Right? So there it is. The fundamental disposition of God toward his people is bless through fertility, multiplication, become great. All right. But then, the story. Sin comes in. Turn to chapter 3. And again, sometimes for all the familiarity, we don't always think all the way through the logic of the line. In Genesis chapter 3, sin comes in, bad things are going to happen, and God begins to, ironically, curse. And so verse 14, the Lord said to the serpent, because you have done this, there's our other word from the story tonight, Numbers. What's that other word? Start from the C.
Curse.
Curse. And the curse because of sin. And so he curses the serpent. But then he says in verse 15, the first hope for mankind, and I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your, in Hebrew, seed and her seed, offspring. And of course, you know, the offspring of the woman will crush the serpent's head even as his own heel is bruised. And I don't know if you ever thought about this, but the beauty of what God does. The original blessing of God upon mankind is create life. And so of all the ways God could choose to redeem, all the ways God could first offer the word of hope, it's through seed, a baby, making life. And that's how I'm going to say, you know, the seed is going to come. A new life is going to come in that's going to shatter the evil that has done this, undo the curse, etc., etc. You with me? And so when God in chapter 12, we have some chapters of some bad stuff and hopeless stories that culminate in the first cycle of, with the flood. And then we come off the flood, new creation, hoping things are going to be better and different. But next thing you know, we're at Babel again. And once again, all mankind, just like in Genesis chapter 6, it's bad. And we're saying, oh, what's the way out? Another flood? No, not another flood. The way out is Abraham. Start the Abraham project. And so again, when you think through the actual kind of logic of the Abraham promise, he calls a barren man and his woman. His wife. People who are living under the curse, you know, in the sense they're dead, death. They can't produce life. And so what does he do? I'm going to miraculously restart life through you. And the life that I miraculously start through you with your son of promise is going to lead to an even greater seed down the road, born of another barren woman, barren not because she's old and never been able to have kids, barren because she's a virgin. God likes his little twists. But I'm going to basically start this project through here. And again, look at the language of what he's going to do there. Think about what he basically says. What he's basically saying is, I'm going to undo the curse and give Eden back. Because he says, verse 2, I'm going to make a great nation of you. I will bless you and make your name great so that you will be a blessing. We don't have to talk about name theology in the Bible, but naming matters. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you I will curse. And then you, all the families, will be... Oh, we're back to our language again. Isn't that interesting? Blessing and curses. God's going to create new life. And the essence of the promise he makes to Abraham, I'm going to basically create miraculous life out of you. They're going to become like the sand of the sea and seashore. In other words, you know, fruitful and multiply. You're going to have kids in spades, man, down the road. It's going to absolutely be an overwhelming number. I'm going to absolutely bless you, fruitful and multiply, and I'm going to give you a land. Well, it sounds like Eden, you know, a creation where you can dwell and we can have relationship again, right? You know, whether you've ever connected the dots or not, what he's really saying is, I'm going to undo the curse of Genesis 1, 2, and, you know, Genesis 3, and I'm going to get you back to Genesis 1 and 2. I'm going to give you a name. You named Adam, and then Adam named Eve. I'm going to make you fruitful and multiply, despite how you're looking right now, so you know it's me doing this for you. I'm going to get you to a place where we can dwell together. I'm going to undo all of that. I'm going to get back to blessing you. But the big thing is, if anybody wants to mess with you for what I'm doing, is I'm determined to be the God of Genesis 1. What am I going to do to him? Curse. Okay? Fundamental dynamic of what's going on there. And so by the same token, when you get down to chapter 27, it's time for Isaac to inherit, if you will. Isaac and Jacob, you know, to kind of keep that promise in the essence of, I'm going to undo the curse and get you back to Eden and fertility and all the good blessings of God. Let's see. I'm going to pick up in verse 27 of Genesis 27. So, and granted, this is Jacob pulling a shenanigan, but Isaac's handing off the baton nonetheless. Isaac smelled the smell of his garments. Oh, it must really be Esau. Oops, it's Jacob. But anyways, see the smell of my son is as the smell of the field that Yahweh has blessed. May God give you of the dew of heaven and the fatness of the earth, plenty of grain and wine. Let the peoples serve you. Nations bow down to you. Be lord over your brothers. May your mother's sons bow down to you. And cursed be everyone who curses you, and blessed be everyone who blesses you. Right? Keep the project going. Keep the project going. And then, for sake of time, you get to chapter 49. And it's time for Jacob to hand out blessings. Familiar chapter. And every son gets some blessings, some better blessings than others, but you get to Judah in particular. And in chapter 49, I'll pick up reading in verse 9. Actually, verse 8. Judah, your brother shall praise you. And that's a play in Hebrew, because Judah's name comes from the Hebrew root for praise. One of them, anyways. Your brother shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's son shall bow down before you. Judah is a lion's club. From the prey, my son, you've gone up. He stooped down. He crouched as a lioness who dares rouse him. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him. To him shall be the obedience of the peoples, etc., etc. And so rule is going to come, as well as God blesses the world through whatever he's up to in Abraham's family. All right. And so what happens if you turn the page to Exodus chapter 1, though, is we fast forward through the centuries. And you get to chapter 1 and verse 7. But the people of Israel were what? That's how it's supposed to work. That's the Abraham promise, but it's really God blessing in the Genesis 1 fashion, right? This is what's supposed to happen. And so the world rejoiced that God is going to bless the world through the seed of Abraham. That's what Egypt did, right? No, when they saw the fruitfulness and the multiplication of them, and they grew exceedingly strong, so the land was filled with them. Verse 9, that Pharaoh says, behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us, so what are we going to do? Squash them. So, for sake of time, because there's never, ever, ever enough time, and we could sketch this out more at length. What then happens is you move from a story where the issue is God intends to bless the world through Abraham, and so here's Balak trying to thwart that. Curse him. Well, that's been tried before, because here's the other thing that happens. For sake of time, well, can't spin that out already because it's already past 7:45, but here's what happens. You've got the creation angle, the kind of the cosmic creation. God is ultimately going to have a Genesis 1 and 2 reality. And he's going to have a people in it. And you and I just got to decide if we're going to be some of those people or not. But he's going to have a Genesis 1 and 2 reality. Okay? That setting, and it's blessing, it's life. It's going to be great. But in the meantime, there's trouble. And so the world does not like the project of God. You know, the world finds ways to rebel, whether it's Babel, or whether it's a Pharaoh who does not know Joseph, in other words, does not know the family of Abraham, and says, what I don't like is they're outnumbering us, they're clearly multiplying like rabbits, and they're going to overpower us. And so what happens, and one of the other reasons the Balaam story matters, is because there are a bunch of parallels between this story here, the Exodus, and the Balaam story. Why does that matter? Because the Exodus story is how this generation begins its journey with God. Numbers 22 to 25 is the end of that generation. Right? Turn the page to chapter 26, and what do you got? You got another census. What's the point of that other census? New generation. New generation, right? The story of the generation of Moses and the Exodus begins and ends with kings. And now you can flip back to chapter 22 with me in Numbers real quick. Kings of nations who are troubled by the fruitfulness, fertility, and therefore numbers of the people in their midst or around them and say, we got to do something about this. In Pharaoh's case, he tries, you know, several ways of doing that. He tries slavery. He tries killing infant males. And when all else fails, he tries the third step, throw the babies in the Nile. And the irony is, in the third attempt, throwing babies in the Nile, what does that lead to? Moses. A baby in the Nile who breaks Pharaoh. And the same is going to happen here in this story, where you've got, you know, Balak will take Balaam three times. And then the third time, you get the ultimate blessing of chapter 24, where the harder the king rebelling against the fruitfulness, the fecundity, and the multiplication, the blessing of God's people upon them, and trying to destroy them, trying to curse them, has it reflect back in a catastrophic way and undo them. And so when you turn to chapter 22, and you look at verse 2, Balak, son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites, and Moab was in great dread of the people because they were, oh, it's an Exodus 1 moment again. Too many of them. They've been fruitful and multiplied. And we're in trouble. Don't like it. Threatens our power. Threatens our place. And so Moab said to the elders of Midian, this horde will now lick up all that is around us as the ox licks up the grass of the field. So Balak son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at that time, sent messengers to Balaam, son of Beor, of Pethor, which is near the river, and it was all the way up by Euphrates, and the land of the people of Moab. to call him, saying, "Behold, a people has come out of Egypt." Oh, see, we're bookending the story. How the story begins for this generation is how the story's going to end, in a sense. We've got these folks from Egypt. They cover the face of the earth. See, what bugs him? They've been fruitful and multiplied. And they are dwelling opposite me. Come now, curse this people, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land. For I know that whom you bless is blessed, and whom you curse is cursed. Oh, that sounds like a familiar phrase. Whoever blesses you is blessed, whoever curses you is cursed. It's like the inversion of that. Out of Balak's own mouth. And so, yeah, you have the basic repetition of the story. And in Numbers 22 and verse 6, you know, reads very similarly in Hebrew to the way Exodus chapter 1 reads in terms of the way it's phrased, even if the translation, your translation, does not completely bear it out. And so you have this basic issue of blessing and cursing, and two kings, one at each place that entered the wilderness and then exit from the wilderness, nations trying to stop God's work. Now here's the next step in kind of recognizing the larger significance of the story in the book of Numbers. And it's this. There's another wordplay. There is a Hebrew word, it's a fun word, it's a heavy-duty word, called kabod, which is fun to say sometimes. Not as fun as saying walk, like, you know, Scottish or something, but hats are fun. You get to spit when you say it. The kavod. And kavod is a fun word because its basic meaning is to be heavy. But the way it works, and the way it works in English, which often gets translated, is it will be used of things that we just translate as heavy. But it means heavy in other ways and semantically. To make somebody heavy is to give them honor. You know, sometimes when somebody has gravitas, they're honorable. They're just, so sometimes it carries with the concept of honor or glory. You know, weighed down. You know, remember Paul, the weight of glory. You know, that's not exactly what he meant, but still, you get the point. You know, so much glory it weighs. You know, to make somebody weigh. So glorification or honor is the idea. So here's the thing. So here's the thing that happens. Again, similarities between how they begin in the wilderness and how they're ending in the wilderness. There is this phrase over and over again about Pharaoh as he's confronted by Moses and sees signs and wonders and plagues and whatnot. Instead of falling on his knees, confessing Yahweh is Lord, my gods are nothing, and letting his people go, Pharaoh repeatedly, what's the famous phrase? Pharaoh hardened his heart. Literally in Hebrew, kavod, makes it heavy. And again, there's all sorts of, you know, kind of semantic, you know, honors himself above God, you know, he's more concerned about his own glory, but he hardens, kavod, his heart. So here's what's interesting. You've got Balaam. And Balaam's really, you know, he kind of strikes honestly as a guy who really didn't have conviction. He's just for hire. He's, you know, he's not convicted, he's just mercenary. And so the reality is, he does, you know, it's more about he wants what Balak is honoring him. And the problem is, I mean, he says the right things, you know, I can't speak but what Yahweh tells me, and, you know, so even the first time, no. And of course, if you read the story, we don't have time to read the story in detail, several chapters, but when you look at the story, you know, the first time when he says no, Balak just assumes it means, he knows the art of the deal. You know, you gotta hold out for more money, so we'll, you know, we'll send even more, and we'll do even better. But look in chapter 22. Look at chapter 22 and verse 17. Alright, so start in verse 16. I'll start in verse 15. Let's just do that. Once again, I know. Once again, Balak sent princes, more in number and more honorable than these. And then came Balaam, and they came to Balaam rather, and said to him, "Thus says Balak son of Zippor, let nothing hinder you from coming to me, for I will surely do you great honor." Same word. But here's the pun. Here's the pun. You know, Balak is saying, I'll honor you, I'll give you glory, I'll pay you off. By the way, we still use that word that way sometimes to this day. Sometimes, especially in academia, somebody goes and gives a lecture, a guest lecture at university, they get paid an honorarium. You ever heard that phrase? Words are fun. Anyways, but here's the pun that's going on here. Just like, again, the parallels in the stories. You start with a Pharaoh who hardens his heart. Balaam has no conviction. He's just mercenary. But he's being hardened by Balak's repeated offers. Honor you really becomes the hardening of Balaam, and Balak just won't let it go and keeps on pushing on him. And so you get this idea. And so it shows up there in chapter 22 and verse 17. Drop down later in the story. After after, you know, he should know better by this point, verse 31, Yahweh opened the eyes of Balaam. He saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way and the sword drawn and learned the lesson. You were nearly a dead man because I know what you're doing and you said it for the money. I know what you're up to. And so you drop down the verse, I think it's verse 37. Yeah. Balaam said to Balak, behold, I have come to you. Now, have I now any power of my own to speak anything? Go back to verse 37. I'll get it right. Balak said to Balaam, did I not sin to you? Why did you not come to me? Am I not able to honor you? But of course, the pun is, what I'm really doing is I'm hardening you. Just like Pharaoh. Balaam wants the money. He wants the attention. He wants the glory. He wants the light on the resume, right? Everybody seeing how LinkedIn works? You know, it's really cool to work a local job, but it's even cooler to work for a higher ranking company, right? You know, as seen on, you know, Fox News, as seen on CNN, as seen on MSNBC, you know, that's really cool. I can say that, man. He wants honor, but it's hardening him. It's hardening him. And so again, the puns continue. The same thing, chapter 24, verse 11. When it just keeps backfiring, keeps on backfiring. The Lord, therefore, now flee to your own place, Balak says to Balaam in frustration. I said I will certainly honor you, but the Lord has held you back from honor. And again, there's a bit of a pun there. You're not going to get paid, but the reality is Balaam is hardened, which is why he will help find a way for people to sin in chapter 25. Make sense? So there's still hardenings and stubbornness and refusals despite the interventions of God to submit to the fact that these are blessed people. These are God's people. Leave them alone. And so, if we had more time, we could spin that out. We could spin that out a bit more. But what I want to do now is I want to go to chapter 24. And I want to notice, strike three. And so Balaam is really overpowered this time to pronounce great blessing. And again, the blessings themselves, we don't have to look at them, but they're interesting. I mean, they deal with fertility and just, you know, the essences of how God blesses. But what happens in chapter 24, these last couple of big blessings that kind of come in round three, they go beyond the present generation. You know, Balaam begins to see the end of the Abraham project. This is going to be big. What's about? These people are blessed. Moab's not going to stop them, just like Egypt didn't stop them. And they're going to get in the land, and big things are coming. God is going to do something big with this, so don't get in the way or you're going to get steamrolled. And so what happens is, and again, chapter 21, let's just start in verse 1, and we're going to jump around a bit. But when Balaam saw it pleased the Lord to bless Israel, he did not go, as at other times, look for omens, but set his face toward the wilderness. And Balaam lifted up his eyes. Oh, that's the word that pops all over his door, his eyes. Anyways. And saw Israel camping tribe by tribe, and the Spirit of God came upon him. He took up his discourse, and he said, the oracle of Balaam, son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is open. And this is important because these last blessings are profound. And so the whole idea is, besides the fact that, you know, he's in the one sense being forced by the Spirit of God to submit, you know, kind of like when the Spirit of God comes on Saul and forces him sometimes, you know, just forces a stubborn man to do what needs to be done. But besides that angle, the whole idea is he's seeing more than just a ragtag band coming limping out of the wilderness. Even though they're organized impressively, we talked about that earlier from the book of Numbers, but still, a bunch of desert nomads coming in, no city, you know, nomadic. There's more than meets the eye. So much of the Bible is learning to see God's work the way God sees it. Who is this? You know, who is despised the day of small things? As Zechariah points out, right when God is restored. Don't. It may not look like much. You know, Book of Amos. God keeps on saying, "What do you see, Amos?" You know. Even the prophets sometimes had trouble looking and seeing what God is up to. Right. Even when their hearts are in the right place, they have a hard time seeing. And so, Balaam's not just seeing the sense of, God is, kind of forcing his eyes open, but he's seeing the spiritual, eschatological reality of what God is up to. And so the oracle of him who hears the words of God, who sees the vision of the Almighty, falling down with eyes uncovered. And so how lovely are your tents, O Jacob, and your campments, like palm groves that stretch far, like gardens beside a river. Wait, gardens beside a river? Okay. you know, you can do this any way you want when you're God and you're inspiring people to say that. Gardens by a river? I remember that from somewhere. Where did I see a garden by a river? Eden, right? Yeah, of course. And what's the irony? Where are these people right now? Wilderness. And, you know, but even, you know, stop thinking of some of the prophets, you know, God will make the wilderness bloom, like, you know, the desert bloom in the end. I mean, just, you know, the undoing of all this. So anyways, yeah, so like aloes that the Lord has planted, like cedar trees beside the waters, water shall flow from his buckets, and his seed shall be in many waters. And his king shall be higher than Agag, his kingdom shall be exalted. God brings him out of Egypt, and it is for him like the horns of the wild ox. He shall eat up the nations, his adversaries. This is kind of like Psalm 2. Right, you know, a coming king rules with a rod of iron. Be wise, O nations, and kiss the sun while you can. Make nice with God before he starts really swinging that rod of iron. Beware, O nations. Yeah, you're getting big stuff here. And he shall break their bones in pieces and pierce them through with his arrows. He crouched, he lay low like a lioness. Who will rouse him up? Blessed are those who bless you, and cursed are those who curse you. Oh, see, that's what this story is really about. All right, but we're not done, because, you know, Balak's frustrated. But verse 14, Balaam responds to Balak. You know, I told you, man, at the end of the day, I'm certainly in it for the money, but, you know, when you deal with these kind of things, sometimes you kind of, you know, the spirit gets you, pardon the pun. And so, verse 14, and now behold, I'm going to my people. Come, I will let you know what this people will do to your people in the latter days. And even in the Pentateuch, when you hear a phrase like latter days, you're not just talking about a week, a month, a year, 10 years from now. Latter days, almost always in the Bible, thinks eschatologically, messianically. And in the Bible, we miss this sometimes. Messianic is not just the first coming. Messianic is the second coming. In the Bible, it's all the Messiah's work, first and second coming. Messiah's not done yet, right? Does Jesus still have more promises to keep? Are there problems? Yeah, there. So that's the thing. And the Old Testament is already showing, not just the first, but the second coming. It's all messianic work. They blur it together sometimes, but it's the anointed of God doing the anointed of God's work. All right. And so he took up this discourse and said, verse 15, the oracles of Balaam, son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened. The oracle of him who hears the words of God, who knows knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down with eyes uncovered. And here comes more fun with seeing. The donkey got to see the angel. Balaam here at the end gets to see even more. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. Oh, we're back to Genesis again. We're back to Genesis, both the beginning and the end, where at the end of Genesis, tribe of Judah, there's going to come a great king from you. And Balaam says, I see him. Not yet, but I see him. He's not near, but I see him. And it shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down the sons of Sheth. Now, of course, what's interesting is, in the sense, the first Messiah was David. Right? He's the type. He's the shadow. And does David ultimately crush Moab? Yep, go back and read Book of Samuel. Yep, he will put Moab in his place. Now, the great irony of that, though, is who was one of David's ancestors? Ruth. And what was Ruth? Moabite. Yeah. Because, again, you know, God always welcomes Gentiles and people who aren't ethnically Jewish. So it was never meant to be an ethnic thing, pure and simple. But eventually, David will deal with Moab. But it's bigger than that. It's not just, you know, eventually, some centuries down the road, Moab's going to show up. Keep reading. Edom shall be dispossessed. Seir also and his enemies shall be dispossessed. Israel is doing valiantly. And one from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of the cities. And for sake of time, because we're really about to get in trouble here, drop down to verse 23, where we go beyond and we look towards something really, really big. And he took up his discourse and said, alas, who shall live when God does? You know, when God comes and starts smashing nations through the rule of this guy who I see, but he's not near and not yet. But when God, through this guy who's come, and starts smashing the nations. Alas, who shall live when God does this? But ships shall come from Kittim and shall afflict Asher and Ever. and then he too shall come to destruction. And then Balaam drops the mic and walks away. This is big, because here's the thing. Ships of Kittim. Sometimes Kittim can be associated, Kittim, go back to them. Asher. Asher is often associated with Assyria and Eber, and similarly Mesopotamia peoples. And back in this era, with Moses' day, you know, sometimes if you've ever heard this, you know, we talk about the Assyrian Empire later. It's really the Neo-Assyrian. Ever, any of y'all ever heard the Assyria Bible called the Neo-Assyrian Empire? The reason it's called the Neo-Assyrian Empire means that there was something before. This era, there was a thriving civilization there in Mesopotamia, you know, in that region before. Asher, you know, is the Hebrew for Assyria, or that region anyways. It's a name that gets recycled a bit. So you've got Asher and Eber. So in other words, you've got the great civilizations of the East. But eventually, ships of Kittim will come. Ships of Kittim means those seagoing people will come. Initially, sometimes, not much, but associated ships of Kittim with the Philistines. Philistines were not ethnically Semitic. They were literally known in other, you know, inscriptions and artifacts as the sea peoples. They were really kind of closer to the Greeks, kind of Mycenaean and whatnot, kind of coming from Crete, Cyprus, up that way, the sea peoples. And they become the Philistines, eventually settled. But ships of Kittim, by the time you get to Daniel chapter 11, remember Daniel has visions of the coming Messiah. You know, Daniel sees all the, you know, the coming kingdoms, eventually in the days of that fourth kingdom, God will set up an even greater ruler, right? You with me? And he talks about Daniel chapter 11, the coming of the ships of Kittim, who were generally understood to be the Romans. And so what you really have here is, what I would argue, is you have an end times picture in which you have eventually the East being subdued by the West. And then overall that eventually he, you know, the coming one who's not near and not yet, who will subdue the ones who have been subduing everybody else. It's an anticipation of in the days of those, you know, in the days of that fourth kingdom, and the ships of Kittim when the Romans come. This guy that I'm really, it's not the first coming of David, it's the second coming of David is what he ultimately sees. And God will do something really great through these people. In other words, this bringing of the people into the land will become ultimately God's bringing the Messiah into the world. And in his days, he will set up a rule and a kingdom that will not end. Right? Sound familiar? Kind of, sort of? Too much, too fast? Shock? Despair? I feel more like the donkey right now. Eventually, somebody, Balaam, says, you tried to stop him. You're not going to stop God's project. He's going to bring his ruler, and he's going to have his kingdom, and his ruler is going to smash all nations, Psalm 2. And he will have his kingdom. He will have his way. You're not going to stop what God do. And God will bless the world. There will be blessing. God will bless the world through this project. He sees the end at the beginning in the plains of Moab. Make sense? So God lets a pagan in on the secret. And again, what's the whole point? You think you can see, you just see some people here. You have no idea what you're really looking at. You have no idea the enormity of what you're looking at. And you just see this group of desert-dwelling people camped around some weird tent in an altar, you know, wandering for 40 years. And the other thing that's important about this as well is, as the bell catches us, this is the end of that Exodus generation. That's why there's parallels. We don't have time to flesh them out fully, but there's parallels between, you know, the Exodus story and this story. But here's the thing. As much as it sounds glorious as chapter 24 wraps up, what happens in chapter 25, the last actual story of the Exodus generation? What actually happens? Another fall. Bad sin and more plague and death. Another fall. And, you know, and so again, you know, it's always that right when you think, finally, man, this thing's going to be up some momentum of its own, the project of God's really going to get going well, human sin keeps on entering back in, human failure collectively. And so you're about to have another fall after you have a very hopeful moment here in chapter 24, another great fall. But here's the point. God's project will not be thwarted. And so despite all the death, you have a good guy named Phinehas who shows up. God gives him an everlasting covenant of peace because he's a guy who gets it. And you turn the page of chapter 26 and there's hope. They're still fruitful and multiplied. There's a whole new list of names and generations. and we still have a chance to pull this thing off. God will not be thwarted. It's part of what the Bible emphasizes over and over again is, boy, we're sinful. And boy, God is amazing in how he still finds ways to give the blessing he is determined to bring to his people and his creation. It will happen, no matter what. All right, we're done. See you next week.